Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. We have an EGOT on the show.
That's a type of kestrel, isn't it?
It's one of only 16 people. There are only 16 EGOTs in the world. There are people who have won an Oscar, a Grammy, an Emmy, and a Tony. So
right.
Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony, EGOT.
Ah, okay. Not to mention countless Ivan Novellos and...
Oh, mate. I mean, he's... You know, he's such a massive force in this industry. And I guess why we're having him on is because it's the 50th anniversary of probably
Jesus Christ Superstar. Yeah, which was the start of, because I guess what he did was one of the people who started to bridge the divide between kind of, you know, rock, popular music and musical theatre.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, those early albums that when he first did Jesus Christ Superstar had Ian Gillan from Deep Purple on there. You know, I think there's a version, there's an album before then of Joseph with Roger Daltrey singing.
Oh.
And he's worked with Rick Wakeman, Elvis. He wrote a song for Elvis. He's done a James Bond theme tune, Freddie Mercury, In Excess. I mean, you know, he's worthy to be on the Rockonteurs, I would have thought.
Absolutely. So let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rockonteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rockonteurs Podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Tim, so lovely to see
Tim.
You.
Tim!
Hi there. Gary.
Hi, Tim.
How are you?
Good to finally see you. Now, I want to get this out of the way, which is the time we met, which was at a party, a 50th birthday party, and I rather drunkenly was telling you about a song that my father wrote, which I believe you were very fond of, which is A Handful of Songs by Tommy Steele.
Yes, I was very fond of a lot of songs that your dad wrote, some with Donald Barton, with Tommy himself, and my favourite, perhaps, was Handful of Songs, which was just a great song, which very much, you know, it's part of my childhood. I was a huge admirer of that album that Tommy did. In fact, it was the first album I think I ever bought. It was a 10-inch album called The Tommy Steele Story, and Handful of Song.
Oh, yeah.
It was also a single. It was a hit single as well. And I just loved that song. And I have performed it live once or twice, not very well.
But really?
Wow.
Yes, and in my youth, I could even do the whistling bit, but I won't do it now.
Oh, my God. I've actually got the Ivor Novello Award for it downstairs. I should have brought it up.
I did not realise it won an Ivor Novello Award.
It did win an Ivor Novello Award, yeah.
As what, Song of the Year or...
It might have been Best Song from a Film.
Well, it was a cracking good song.
Because I know you're such a sort of a nerd about rock music and the history.
Hang on. Yes.
But in a good way, about the history of rock music.
Words matter, Gary.
Yeah, I know, but of course they do, as far as Tim is concerned. And Tommy Steele, you know, remind our audience of the importance of this man. He was the first rock and roller, wasn't he?
Well, he was the first British rock and roller. Yeah. Of course, he wasn't the first rock and roller, as he was. He came to fame in England sometime after rock and roll had... wasn't a long time after, but probably a few months.
It was on the back of the skiffle thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, the skiffle thing was going at almost simultaneously, and his first hit was Rock with the Caveman, which was, I got the impression that it was almost a kind of spoof of rock and roll, but actually it was a very good rock and roll record, very short, only lasted about a minute and 40 seconds. And
my dad also co-wrote.
Yeah, he had a great song.
And Ronnie Scott played the sax solo.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, it was a good record. I'm sure it got, you know, a few bad reviews from the old guard at the time, but it stands up very well today. But the song that really established Tommy as a major pop star, of course, was Singing the Blues, which was a cover. I believe that was after A Handful of Songs. My exact geography or history of those times is a little wobbly, as I haven't got my reference books in front of me. But... Singing the Blues was actually a cover, as I'm sure some people know, of the Guy Mitchell hit in America. And it was basically kind of a copy, but It was a copy only in its orchestration and arrangement. The difference for me in the two records was that Guy Mitchell, who was an extraordinarily successful pop singer in America, had a lot of hits and had been going since about 1952. He sang it pretty straight. It was a good song, Singing the Blues, and Guy sang it. You can't criticize it. He just did it really well. Tommy, almost instinctively, did a rock and roll vocal on it, even though it was the same tempo and the same, in a way, the same backing as Guy Mitchell's version. And it showed him to be something rather more original than the traditional, the pop music tradition that Guy Mitchell and Frankie Lane and Johnny Ray and all those great singers had dominated for a long time. It was the way he sort of... there was a definite Elvis feel to it, as well as the fact that it was a great country semi-rock song. And I still, to this day, think that Tommy's version was more interesting than Guy Mitchell.
And because Tommy was in the Navy, wasn't he? He was going to America and he was picking up records and bringing them into the country for the first time.
And he saw Buddy Holly.
That's right, yeah.
One of the few people from England to have seen Buddy Holly over there in America. Buddy Holly came to England once, which I didn't see him. I was too young, annoyingly. But Tommy, being a sailor, travelling a lot to America as a very young man, in the Navy, Merchant Navy, he came back with a lot of records which he heard over there, which you couldn't get in England. I mean, people sometimes forget that the world in the 50s, and indeed up until about the Beatles' time, it was very separate. Mm. If something happens now in one country in the music business, it happens almost simultaneously around the world. Whereas in those days, you could have artists who had entire careers which no one knew about in America, they wouldn't necessarily mean very much in England and vice versa. And it was very hard for people to listen to anything but the very big pop hits from the United States. And someone like Tommy getting hold of some of these lesser-known records, the blues records, the country records, the rock and roll, that made a big difference.
And were you listening to this stuff as well?
Yeah.
Not really.
So were you getting hold of it?
He's too young. He's too young, Guy.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yes, quite. Thank you.
Sorry.
I mean, I was listening to Elvis and Buddy Holly, and Eddie Cochran and the Everly Brothers probably were my early favourites. Chuck Berry. But even Chuck Berry was a little esoteric back then. And, of course, the British rockers, who weren't bad. I mean, they sometimes get a bit knocked as being copies of the Americans. But, in a way, all the Americans were copying somebody. I mean, Elvis merged country and rhythm and blues. Everybody's influenced. And some of the British pop singers, had they been American, like Marty Wilde or Billy Fury or good old Cliff, they would have had every chance to have succeeded in America. But
they frankly had better names than the Americans as well. You know, all those names were just amazing.
Yeah. Billy Fury, Marty Wilde. Yeah.
Vince Eager,
yeah. Yeah.
But they all managed by the same guy, though.
Yeah, Larry Parnes.
Larry Parnes. Larry Parnes.
Them all names, including, Joe Brown, who is a great artist and is still around today, wonderful guitarist. Great early British rocker and really almost folk singer at times. Great country singer, great rocker. And Joe was going to be called something terrible. He wanted to call him, Gary Twitch or Larry something. I don't know what it was. But he absolutely refused to take this name and said, I'm going to be Joe Brown. And
not Gary Glitter, one hopes.
No.
Because Larry Parnes, he actually set up like a charm school for rock and rollers in sort of Southampton or somewhere, didn't he?
He used to coach them. They would be trapped in his house for God knows how long. Peter Sellers does a very funny takeoff, or did a very funny takeoff back in, about two or three years later, of Larry Parnes and his pop stars who, having trouble knowing which way around to hold the guitar and all that. And, but it was a bit unfair on some of the stars who were actually rather good, as I said before, Marty and Billy and co. But it was a devastatingly funny, not completely exaggerated take on Larry Parnes' stable of stars. But,
I have to say that I think that we sort of came a bit full circle recently, didn't we? It was sort of Simon Cowell and X Factor.
Yes, good point.
And it felt like we were going back to the 50s again.
I kind of thought that before with the whole dance scene, where it became, because in the 50s, really like where my dad worked in Tin Pan Alley, where you basically just had all these songwriters and they would churn out songs. And how big your song was depended on how many people sang it. Right, a hit was when lots of singers sang it. And basically, that's what dance music was. You had all these people in back rooms churning out records, and it was how many DJs played it.
Absolutely.
That made it in.
Yes.
No, it's the same thing.
No, it's true. I mean, it's certainly interesting that the day of the jobbing songwriter who, you know, would write songs in Tin Pan Alley and then try and get as many covers as possible on each song, that's long gone, because not that many artists in those days wrote their own stuff. A lot of the country artists did, and the blues guys did, but the straightforward pop people were usually relied on songs written for them by great pop songsmiths, pre-Brill building days, you know, your Sammy Kahns and people like that.
Well, it was a separate job, wasn't it, before the Beatles? It was a separate thing.
Yeah.
If you were going to be a singer, it would never occur to you to be...
Yeah.
Sorry, I suppose people like Anthony Newley broke the mould there.
Well, there were one or two. I mean, even, to be fair, the Shadows, they wrote a lot of their stuff, mainly instrumental, but I always feel the Shadows are very underrated, even though, you know, in Britain, everybody knows who they are, and they were hailed quite rightly as being... Great.
Well, every guitar legend we've had on, every guitar legend you ever speak to, you know, Beck, Gilmore, Clapton, anyone, they all just say Hank.
Yeah.
You know, he's absolutely got that mantle.
Now, Hank Marvin was a brilliant and very influential figure. And Bruce Welch, I mean, is an outstanding rhythm guitarist. And it's almost only in more recent years that I've come to realise just how important a great rhythm guitarist is. I mean, Don Everly was considered the king of rhythm guitars.
I had a really sweet meeting with Bruce Welch a couple of weeks ago, who was, you know, we had Hank on, and he'd heard a rumour that Hank had said it was his guitar, and why was Bruce going? Of course, I don't think it was quite like that. And Bruce went to great lengths to tell me that it was Cliff's guitar. It just happens to be residing at Bruce's house.
Yeah, there's still something dodgy going on there. Whichever way you look at it, there's something dodgy going on there.
This is the first Stratocaster to ever be brought into the
Shadows UK. But influenced the Beatles. I mean, they got going so young. And Hank and Bruce and Brian, who joined them a little bit later, and Jet Harris, they were the same age as the Beatles. I mean, they made it when they were in their 16, 17, 18. And really, they were pioneers. They didn't have anything to base their acts on so much as the Beatles did. I'm not, you know, obviously the Beatles were pretty good. But by the time the Beatles made it, they were all in their early 20s. And the Shadows, in fact, are no older than the Beatles, and Cliff is younger than John Lennon. So it was extraordinary. In a way, the Shadows were slightly unlucky to make it so early, because it was in an era when America was miles away. You couldn't just leap on a plane and go to the States. There was no television linking the two countries. They conquered Great Britain, and nobody was surprised when Cliff and the Shadows didn't conquer America. We all thought they were brilliant, but nobody expected any British act to be a big star in America at that stage.
But obviously they became obsessed with doing instrumentals, which were never going to be quite as...
If anyone has listened to this podcast from the beginning and doesn't actually know who we're talking to, you would have no idea that we are talking to one of the all-time greats of musical theatre. We are so far away...
Well, I know. But you know what? It was an interesting juncture, Tim Rice, a second ago when we were talking about how there was a period when writers wrote for the stars and stars never, ever wrote. And then obviously suddenly from the Beatles onwards, they did. So you're coming along a little bit of an anachronism, aren't you? Initially starting out with Andrew, were you always thinking... the only place for us to work is the stage, or were you going after artists to write for? I mean, obviously, one of those was Elvis eventually. Yeah.
that was a bit lucky. I mean, Andrew had this burning ambition to write for the theatre, and writing for the theatre, certainly in those days, even though the Beatles and the Stones were, you know, right at their peak, it was very much the sort of stuff we were writing. We were expecting, or hoping against hope, that it would be covered by people. I mean, we were not the artists. And I think in theatre, the difference between the writers and the performers is still there. I mean, you do get some, obviously, the odd show where like Anthony Newley, when people perform and write and sing, in other words, do everything themselves. But we weren't trying particularly to write hit songs. And I think if we had been trying to write hit songs, by that I mean hit songs for the hit parade or for the top 40. I mean, a song like Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, which did become a big pop hit, we would never have written it if we just sat down and said, right, let's write a hit pop song for the charts. Let's aim for
Avisa Perón. We need to get back.
But that's a lovely moment, Guy. Can I bust in there? Because I'm going to get you to do this in a bit, Tim. A bit of it. Because Don't Cry For Me did have a different title, didn't it? Wasn't it Kansas City?
No,
heard you sing it in completely different lyrics.
The research is brilliant, but you've confused two cock-ups.
I Don't Know How to Love Him
was originally a song called Kansas Morning. And when we were trying to write pop songs, I mean, Andrew had written this wonderful tune before we even had the idea for Superstar. And I wrote a pretty awful lyric to it, Kansas Morning, because it seemed to me that in those days you had a good chance of a hit if you stuck an American place name into it. You know, it was Massachusetts and I Left My Heart in San Francisco and the lights of Cincinnati.
24 Hours from Tulsa, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. 24 Hours from Tulsa. That was a great one. And I thought, Kansas, you know, I'd never been to Kansas. I still haven't. I've been lucky to go to most states, but I've never been to Kansas. We wrote this terrible song. Well, I wrote this terrible lyric, I should say, which was, I love the Kansas morning. And it was all about a bloke who was in prison in Maine. And the reason he was in prison in Maine was that Maine was a word that rhymed with a lot of other words. Whereas if he'd been imprisoned in Arkansas, it wouldn't have worked. Anyway, it was a pretty awful song, thanks to the lyric. And then when it became, if I may immodestly say so, quite a substantial hit, as I Don't Know How to Love Him, I felt on the one hand, well, what a wally you were to do Kansas Morning. On the other hand, it made me think, yeah, you've got to have good words to get a good hit. You know, I mean, if the words don't work or if they're stupid, unless it's meant to be, you know, Shut Up, You Face, which I think is quite a good song, actually. A bad lyric can kill a good tune. As I proved.
Because we've missed the start here, which is how you and Andrew found each other and how you found you were a lyricist. I mean, did you just wake up one day and went, lyrics? That's what I wanted. I mean, you love music. I mean, did you want to write music or?
Well, I was always quite good at writing words at school and essays and the old poem. And I used to do funny poems occasionally. One of the punishments at school was to write 300 words or to write. And I kept getting more and more punishments because one of the prefects said in the end, say, well, we like to give you punishments because your essays are usually very funny. And they just wanted to read the essays. I said, well, I would have done them, you know. Anyway, who'd ask politely?
You would have been made for Punch if you were born a century earlier.
Yes, really. I enjoyed that, I think. But I did write one or two pop songs on my guitar with three chords. And one of them, to my amazement, got recorded. I'd written the tune as well. So when I met Andrew, who was doing a similar
This is the thing, you hear this a lot with people from, especially in the 60s, they go, and two people recorded my songs. What is the path from you in a room to that being done by someone?
Well, it was a strange path in a way because I made a demo tape in 65 before I met Andrew, which was later that year, of me singing three songs I'd written. And I was trying to sell the voice rather than songs, my voice. And they were sort of slightly Dylan Donovan-ish, you know, quite simply structured, but they weren't absolutely awful, but they weren't, on the other hand, particularly good. But I sent them around to all the record companies. Well, there were only about four then worth sending stuff to. And I didn't get any response until one music publisher rang me up, Mills Music, a chap called Cyril G. And Cyril said, I've been sent this tape by a record company, you know, because they said they thought the voice was pretty awful, but the songs were okay. And maybe possibly something would work. And Cyril then said, well, who sang? I said, I don't know, somebody. I wasn't interested in, you know, he was just doing me a favor. Cyril said, well, I think one of the songs we could get recorded. And he got a cover on it from an unknown band called The Night Shift, who did at one point have Jeff Beck in their ranks. And I'm not sure whether sure whether Jeff was on my record. I did meet Jeff Beck once and he said he thought he was, but there's a dispute.
Well, he was.
Yeah, he was.
You can usually tell when Jeff Beck is on a record.
Jeff, of course, wasn't known then, but it did actually appear on an album, a CD, many, many years later, you know, the best of Jeff Beck or early Beck or something.
Where would you have done your demo then? I mean, not on the booth on Waterloo Station where Gary and I used to do things when we were kids.
My first demo was at home on a Grundy reel-to-reel. But having gone to a good second division public school, Lancing College...
Oh, it's up the road
here. Very privileged.
I judged the music competition there a couple of years ago. Yes.
Well, unfortunately, I was there a bit before you did that. But
yeah, you would have won.
Have you heard the name Tony Hall? He was a seriously important disc jockey, music critic, and he also ran Decca Promotion Department. And I wrote to Tony Hall because he was at Lancing College way before me. I mean, he died not that long ago, actually, aged about 90-something. But I wrote to Tony and said, I'm terribly sorry to use the old school tie, but I've written a few songs, and I wrote a long letter to him. And I got a reply very generously, and he's obviously a busy bloke. It kept sending very groovy telegrams saying, sorry, haven't replied. I'm out in the north of England with the Righteous Brothers, and sort of these totally groovy telegrams. I thought, wow, this is fantastic. Anyway, he fixed an audition for me. And I went along to Decca Studios in Hampstead, and Arthur Greenslade, who was a well-known arranger at the time, I showed him the stuff, and I mean, he hadn't seen anything until I came into the studio, and they were just three or four chords. And I made some demos of three of the songs I'd written.
So is that with a band then?
No, just or, Arthur no, just on the him, piano, just, and right. me, I think I was strumming my guitar rather badly in the background, but singing, basically. It was they were just to sell the songs. And that was the tape I sent to, thanks to Tony Hall, the tape I sent to record companies. And there was no result except this Cyril G somehow got hold of one, and it was therefore covered by The Night Shift, who I'm afraid I probably finished their career off because it wasn't.
But thanks to you, they are now actually all on The Night Shift. And this is the second instance we've had of this kind of public school old boys network, because Genesis got their first break because Jonathan King was a Charterhouse old boy.
Right, right. Yeah. I know it's grossly unfair, but I dare say that the old state school has had that link occasionally. But the interesting thing was that I had this record, and as I'm sure you would both appreciate, even though you're so much younger than me, but having your name on a 45 RPM record was, you were on the bottom rung of the ladder. Nowadays, anybody can make a record, and it may be good and it may be garbage, but anybody can make one. You know, if you say, I've made a CD, people say, oh yeah, who hasn't? But in those days, nobody had a record pressing plant in their front room. To get your name on a proper label in any capacity was...
Absolutely.
Yeah, but Tim, let's just say how unfortunate it is now for young writers who don't get their name written on Spotify or Apple Music.
Yeah, I agree.
It's just the title of the artist and the title of the song.
Yeah.
At least, you know, you would have had seen your name in brackets beneath the title.
I did, and it was very exciting. And because I had this 45 in my hand, it was on the Piccadilly label, which was one of Pye's labels. It was a perfectly legit label. It had quite a few hits. I think Joe Brown, funny enough, was on Piccadilly at the time. And everywhere I went, I took this record with me to, you know, just to try and impress people, maybe get a job. And I went to a book publisher because I had this bonkers idea for a book about the history of the charts. You know, the printing all the charts, and the book publisher didn't like the idea, but he said, what else do you do? And I said, well, I've written this song, and I whipped out my song, which was called That's My Story by The Night Shift. And he played it, and he said, no, I don't like that either. But he said, but I do know a young man who wants to write with somebody because he can't do lyrics as well as he can do tunes. And this was A. Lloyd Webber. I did think he ought to change his name. You know, he'll never make it with that long handle. But I went to meet Andrew, and those days there was no email, there were no mobiles. I wrote him a letter, and he called me back at my office. And as a result, I went round to meet him. I was in the law office at the time. I was trying to be a law student and failing. And I went round to Andrew's parents' house, or flat rather, where he was living. And he said, oh, I'm going to write for the theatre. And he really wanted to be the next Richard Rodgers, or indeed the next Lionel Bart, who was at his peak at that point. It was clear to me, pretty sharpish, that he was rather good because he sat at the piano and said, and he played all these tunes, and, you know, they were just very good. They were very much in the theatre tradition. There wasn't much rock feel, although he did have a good collection of rock and roll albums. I mean, I didn't even have any albums, barely. I had about four or five albums and lots of singles. He had reams of albums, and they were beautifully kept, and I was very impressed. Anyway, he said, do you know anything about theatre? And I said, oh, yes, which I didn't. He'd done a musical based on the story of Dr. Bernardo, the Victorian philanthropist. He'd written it at school at Westminster, where he was at, and he'd written it with a fellow pupil called Robin Barrow. And Robin wanted to do something insane, like become a doctor. He didn't want to stay in the music business or theatre business.
Madness!
So when he left school, you know, he decided he didn't want to do any more lyrics. And Andrew was therefore had a story and he had a score, but no words. And I took over, and that show never got anywhere. But it was very derivative and too much influenced by Lionel Bart, who was one of our heroes.
Lots of Cockney kids.
Yeah, we had Cockney kids. It was set in the 19th century. It was all that. It was a bit like Oliver too, but not as good. But it was.
Use a toff and no mistake.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh, you saw the show, did you? No, it was a good.
No one was imprisoned in Maine.
No. that would have been better, I think.
Joseph was the breakthrough for you. I mean, listen. We're going to get on to Jesus Christ Superstar because it's rock opera, and we are the rock auteurs, and we need the difference between Jesus Christ Superstar and Joseph is immense.
Yeah.
Why did you go and choose that biblical story?
Well, while we were waiting for our Bernardo musical to hit Broadway in the West End, which it never did, but we'd made some demos, and a schoolmaster friend of Andrew's heard the demos and thought they were rather good. And he said he's got to do something for his kids' end of term school concert. Would we like to write something? And this was for us a bit of a come down after our dreams of West End and Broadway. But we thought, well, you know, at least we'll see our work done. And Alan said, there was no money in it. Adam was the teacher. But an educational publisher might hear it, and then it can be sent to schools and it could become a sort of educational hit for music teachers. And he said, but choose a subject that won't date too much, you know, because we said, well, we could do a James Bond musical. And Alan said, no, James Bond, or he'll be forgotten in 5 years' time. How wrong could you be? But actually, I thought, well, that probably the Bible would be good ideas. And Joseph was my favourite Bible story as a kid. It was a good story and an opportunity for fun. And I wanted to make it funny, which I was quite good at. And so we began sending these one-a-week songs off to Alan's kids to be taught, you know, for them to learn. And when he came to the end-of-term school concert, it went down so well with the parents. The headmaster said, we've got to do this again. In a bigger hall, so the dads who were managed to get out of it by saying they were in the office, they can come too. And it was played again, and it got, by an absolute fluke, a rave review in the Sunday Times for a school concert. And that was because we did not realise that the Sunday Times is music.
Okay, which journalist went to Lancing College?
No, it's almost that. We had no idea that Derek Jewell, who was the Sunday Times music man who wrote about rock and pop. And that was quite a new field for the Sunday papers in those days. His son was at the school and was in the choir. And he went along on, you know, the evening performance mainly for the dads who hadn't seen it. And he thought it was so good, he wrote a rave review about it in the Sunday Times. And said, look out for these two lads. And then we got an offer to make a record of it. And it just grew from there. We didn't make any instant fame or money out of Joseph, but it just got us going.
This started the thing that you did, which is a brilliant pioneering thing that the two of you did, which is that you make a record as a way of raising the funds or whatever, or getting the profile to put the show on.
Absolutely.
As opposed to, which is brilliant, it's completely the other way around to how other people do it.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, we didn't know what we were doing because obviously we didn't think Joseph was a show. It did turn out to be, but we just thought it was something for schools. So the record was an obvious move. When it came to Superstar, and what Joseph finally did for us, we did one more performance of it in St. Paul's Cathedral. We were invited to take part in some St. Paul's festival, which was great. And we had a rock group playing in it, but they were very good. And it went down really well. And that performance got us proper management. And then we were offered salaries just to exist. I mean, not much, about 1,500, 2,000 quid a year each. That seemed a lot. And because of our connection with the Dean of St. Paul's, we had this weird idea to do something on the life of Jesus seen through the eyes of Judas Iscariot. And again, we were thinking theatre. We wanted it to be something that could be staged, but nobody wanted to stage it. Our manager, David Land, was hawking it around to the theatrical friends of his, the Cameron McIntoshes of the day. Mm-hmm. But they all said, no, this is an outrageous idea, or religion won't work. So we were forced in the end. The only person who wanted to do it was a guy at MCA Records called Brian Brolly. And MCA Records were a great company for us because they had a small office in London, which meant we were one of their very few acts. But they had worldwide companies around the world just at the time when the album and worldwide record companies were really where you had to be. And we were therefore forced, in a way, out of desperation, to make an album rather than go for a show. And thank God we did, because then we could make it more rock. We had to aim for the radio. And the actual piece wasn't influenced by that, but the way it was done was. And Andrew was able to put huge forces together, like an orchestra and a choir and a rock band, which you would never have done in those days in the theatre.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tim, let's step back a little bit. Was it called Jesus Christ Superstar when you were... What a great title this is for the time you were living.
Also, because the word superstar had only just been invented, yes. Hadn't it? I remember.
I looked it up some years later. I think it was coined somewhere obscure in about 1938. But I first was aware of it when I saw a big ad for Tom Jones in the Melody Maker or something. And it just said, the world's number one superstar. And there was a picture of Tom Jones. And I thought, what a great word superstar is. And we'd written the song, or I'd more or less written the song Superstar, but it just went, Jesus Christ, dum, bum, bum, bum. It didn't have the word superstar in it. And I thought, let's put that in and call the whole show. I mean, if you look on the very first single, Murray Head, of that song, even though the song was by then called Superstar, it said from the forthcoming musical or opera, Jesus Christ. It didn't say Superstar. So it took a bit of time for that to happen. But everybody, when they heard the title Jesus Christ Superstar in 1969, they thought, wow, you either loved it or hated it without hearing it. And it was a bit like the Sex Pistols in a way, you know, the Sex Pistols, you couldn't ignore them. You either were very right. pro them or very anti them. And to a certain extent, Superstar was like that.
Because we'll get on to that, because obviously it caused a lot of problems, especially with the religious community in America.
Especially when you I only recently found out that you hosted that brilliant TV debate with the Pythons, who, you know, whose original title for Life of Brian was Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory.
Yes. Well, that was, I mean, that's a bit jumping ahead, but it was extraordinary that one of the shows I had featured Michael Palin and John Cleese up against the Bishop of Southwark and Malcolm Muggeridge.
That's right. It was amazing. It's amazing. It's all on YouTube. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I know. And people forget that the first half of the show, which was fine, was me interviewing Paul Jones of Manfred Mann, who's one of my favourite singers, and Norris McWhirter, who founded the Guinness Book of Records. And I thought, well, this might be the best part of the show, the first half. But of course, it's because I was a bit worried about the Bishop and the Malcolm Muggeridge. But we got the most ding-dong fantastic battle, which I hardly got a word in edgeways. I mean, I was meant to be the host, and I was thinking, well, I can always say this sort of thing happened to us with Superstar 10 years ago, which it did, but we never got onto a TV chat show being harangued by religious leaders. We were just harangued outside the theatres, mainly.
Sorry, I just want to take a little left... Sorry, really sorry, Gary. I just want to take a little left turn here, because you've just reminded me of something. I just want... Only a couple of years ago, I found out that Paul Jones did these sort of pop recordings of Sex Pistols songs, and apparently that was your idea. He told me about it, yeah. Because your idea, what your thought was that, like, Anarchy in the UK and stuff, they are just nice pop songs. They just haven't been done right.
My favourite Sex Pistols track was Pretty Vacant. I thought it's a rather good song. And
it is, yeah, absolutely.
Did a version of that, and Sheena is a Punk Rocker by the Ramones, I think it was. And we did them with strings and Paul singing almost like they were ballads, which they worked in a way. I mean, the record didn't go, but one or two people quite liked it. It got a bit of airplay, but... I think some of the Sex Pistols fans were rather sort of offended by this.
But obviously, I mean, offending people was what you did.
I can't think of anything more punk than...
We had a Paul wearing a punk badge on the cover of the single, I think, but it didn't do anything. But I was always, you know, fooling around doing strange records, none of which really came off. But
let's get back to Jesus Christ Superstar. Because I think what people forget now, because it's become so part of the establishment and part of the cultural ether, is the irreverence of it. you know, Woodstock had only just happened. And so you turn the Jesus scenario into a kind of Woodstock. This is a hippie leader. This isn't the first time this sort of thing's been done. You go back to sort of people like Bruegel, who was, you know, people who would paint Jesus in their own time, you know, as though he was living there with them. And you were turning this man.
You were sort of demessiahing
him.
And
that's what the religious community were outraged by, right?
Well, some of them were.
The religious right, let us say, maybe. I don't know what you'd call it.
Yeah, well, the religious right, to a certain extent, down in the South, but we didn't actually go down there very much at the time. We had a ridiculous charge of anti-Semitism, which I was rather offended by that, which we defended successfully. But basically, the press, then as now, would blow up any controversy and make it seem bigger than it was. And although we did get a lot of protest at the time, it was very little that was actually dangerous or worrying to us. We got far more. We got thousands and thousands of fan letters, which we never were able to open, which the record company got. And again, you know, I must remind you that, or indeed everybody, that there was no email in those days. Post was the important thing, and protesting outside theatres was the way to do it. And obviously it was controversial, but I think when you see something like Jesus Christ Superstar, most people said, wow, this is interesting. And even if I don't like it, I want to go and see it.
I mean, he ends up on a cross at the end. I mean, it's quite a shocking image, isn't it, for a sing-along musical?
It's a, you know, genuinely terrifying story. And from the point of view of Judas, I mean, I always thought, even as a kid, why was Judas, you know, he seemed like a bit of a fall guy, really. And the strange thing is that in the Gospels, which is the only... virtually the only record that we have of Jesus's life, he doesn't really have a point of view. He doesn't say anything much. He's just the guy who betrayed his master. And he must have had a reason for doing it beyond 30 pieces of silver. That was something which I found intriguing. And to a lesser extent, Pontius Pilate, who was unfortunate, in my view, that he happened to be the man in charge of that particular outpost of the Roman Empire at that time, because in the creed and the Catholic creed and the Christian creed, it's, you know, it says, I believe in blah, 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 our Lord who suffered under Pontius Pilate. And I think, well, he did, but it wasn't really Pontius Pilate's fault. He happened to be the bloke around at the time. I mean, these are all thoughts I had as a kid, really. And I thought, and obviously they were things I was able to expand on when we came to write the show, which I rather enjoyed.
We should talk about the album because, you know, being, you know, a show predominantly about rock, you make this incredible rock album, and I've had another listen to it. And I forgot how, you know, can I use that word? Proggy it is at times, you know.
Yay, there it is.
And Ian Gillan as Jesus Christ from Deep Purple. We'll get there, but I just also want to just say that I did a little bit of research into the term rock opera, Tim. And it says that apparently the story of Simon Simopath by a band called Nirvana in 1967 gets credited an English psychedelic band from London who sued Nirvana and made a lot of money out of court for stealing their name, apparently, even though you've never heard of them. That was apparently the first rock opera.
Well, it might have been. I don't know of it, actually, to be honest. I think I've even heard of it until you just mentioned it.
Yeah.
Obviously, The Who's Tommy was billed as a rock opera, and that came out shortly before we did.
And but, SF Sorrow by The Pretty Things, though, which was before that
was a little later. A little later.
That was before Tommy.
No, was it?
Yeah, I think, but I'm pretty sure.
You're probably right. Sorry. I was unaware of SF Sorrow at the time, I think.
But Tommy was an inspiration in many ways.
Tommy was the one that lifted the curtain.
But I think, and you know, I'm a great fan of Pete Townshend and Roger Daltrey and the lads, but I don't think we were particularly up with Tommy when we were doing Superstar. I think it came out in 69 and I was aware of it and I loved the singles, but we kind of thought of it, maybe wrongly, as a great Who record because it was all sung by the one group and performed by the one group. We felt it was nothing like what we were doing. And in a way, it wasn't, because we were using lots of different performers and characters and dealing with a very old-fashioned story, not very old story, whereas Pete was doing a brilliant story from his own brain. And everything by the four members of the band plus one or two sessions.
Was Ian Gillan in Deep Purple when he was when he sang the Jesus
he
part?
Just about joined it. His manager was a chap called Tony Edwards, And we'd had a tiny success with the Superstar single with Murray. And we were frantically writing the rest of the show, which we'd had drafted out, and we were working out how to record it and who to record it with, because MCA had given us a deal. And Tony Edwards read this story, and we said in passing, Murray was going to sing the part of Judas, and we were looking for someone to sing the part of Jesus. And Tony Edwards came round with some tapes of one or two of his artists who were good, but they were sort of balladeers, you know, Andy Williams, that sort of thing. Right. Not what we were trying to do at all. And we said, no, really, this has got to be rock. And Andrew played on the piano one or two of the songs that we'd written, including Gethsemane, and saying this should be, you know, really almost screamed. Tony Edwards, he said, I think I've got the chap for you. And he came back with a copy of Ian Gillan singing Child in Time. And he said, this is from the new Deep Purple album. And it's a new lineup of Deep Purple, one or two guys the same, but Ian is the new lead vocalist. And we didn't know Ian Gillan at that point, but we heard his voice, and Andrew said, that's exactly what I want. I can tell you for sure, we did not know anything about Ian Gillan. I know he was in episode 6, but they never quite made it. Ian's voice was new to us, and we were very excited by it. And Ian and Tony came round again, and we played them the stuff, and we went into the studio pretty quickly. And Ian did a fantastic job. And I'm still in touch with him. I saw both him and Murray not that long ago. And it was really great for him because he had that going. I mean, he was number one in the American charts with Superstar, and simultaneously breaking through as one of the really big heavy metal bands with Deep Purple.
The one thing I forgot to ask you, and was on my mind, was Jesus Christ Superstar the first sung-through musical?
Well,
meaning there's no talking in between the songs?
Depends. I mean, if you go back to Gilbert and Sullivan, or, you know, that far back, but of its time, it was probably the first. I mean, most of the big musicals that we were admiring and just before us were not sung through. But a lot have been sung through since, like Les Mis and shows like that. So I think we influenced a few people.
Was that a conscious decision, or was that because you did the album first?
Because we did the album first. Yeah. And that was another reason why the sheer good fortune in doing the album first, we did it as a complete piece of music, sung through, operatic in form. We originally thought, had we had a theatrical producer take it on, we probably would have written a really bad book for it with, you know, people saying, hi, Judas, what's for supper, you know, and things like that. It would have been terrible.
That's actually really important, because you are dealing with really mythical, heightened characters that we can't imagine speaking. Okay, we imagine people speaking in Shakespearean language, but not in real language. But so singing, all of them singing, that kind of works.
It does. I mean, that's a very good point. That's really why musicals sometimes, or indeed opera, has the opportunity to transcend storyline and everything. It's simultaneously real and not real. People, if they like what they're hearing, within the first few minutes, they're drawn into it. And then they, obviously they can tell people are singing, but they get used for the 2 hours or so. This is what the life of this piece is. This is what we're hearing on stage. And they're totally used to it being sung. And if somebody suddenly said a few words, it would be a bit of a jolt. They'd say, hang on, you know, this isn't right. This is meant to be sung. And we were very lucky, I think. We had to make it shorter because we had two albums, two discs. It couldn't be too long. And most musicals are too long, in my view, including some of ours. It had to be concise. It had to be rock. It had to be all sung. All these things helped it. And if we'd gone to theatre first, which we tried to do, it probably wouldn't have been a success at all.
Mm.
Would it? No. And I would not be on this show now.
So, Evita.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, this is mind-boggling. We need a musical. What's a hit musical idea? I know. Argentinian. No, not the Argentinian president. His wife.
Well,
I know. She was the great cultural figure. But
well, she was the star. She was a very important part of the Argentine.
Who was aware?
Yeah, because, Tim, you've gone with someone who's the most famous figure in the world to someone that hardly anyone has ever heard of.
It was pretty niche, should we say.
Well,
although cast a shadow over Argentina forever, this incredibly contradictory form of politics.
I remember people saying to us when Superstar was mooted before it became a big hit, say, well, some of the theatrical producers were saying, well, it's a story everybody knows. There's, you know, it's too well known. It can't work. With Eva Perón, they said the opposite. Nobody knows the first thing about her. How can this work? But it did work, and it wasn't our original choice. We were going to do a show on Jeeves and Bertie Wooster, which Andrew ended up doing, but not with me, because I didn't think it was going to work. And Ava Perron became my... It was an idea I heard. I was inspired by a radio program on her, which I heard by chance. This is pre-SatNav. If there'd been SatNav, you wouldn't have a Vita, because I was on my way to a dinner somewhere at some friend's house, and I was lost. And because I was lost, I heard the beginning of a show on the radio, you know, and it was something called Legends of Our Time.
Oh, so this will be a Radio 4 documentary.
Yeah, it was. It was a half an hour Radio 4 documentary. And I thought, this is interesting. And then I got to the house and I thought, I better try and listen to this on the you know, replay, because it was on again later in the week. And I heard it. And the thing is, I did know a tiny bit about her, not much, but more than most people. I'd been aware of her from collecting stamps when I was a kid. And for some reason, I remembered in the papers reading, I was very young, but I do remember reading about her death. And so I knew she was Argentine, glamorous, and dead.
Those are the three keys to a hit musical.
Yeah. And this is also why taxi drivers don't write hit musicals, because they just know their way around, right?
So. Yes. That's very, very true. Very good. But I did a lot of research. I went down to Argentina, and Andrew at that point, you know, he was doing Jeeves, and I don't think he quite thought it was a good idea, but Jeeves, which, you know, I shouldn't say this, but Jeeves helped me by not being a big success. And Andrew realized that perhaps it was a mistake to, in a way, go back into the past at this stage in our careers, go back to other styles when we'd sort of, by mistake, forged our own style. So he said, right, let's do this Ava Perón thing. And we did. And by that time, I'd already drafted out the storyline and all that. So, and again, we thought this time we will deliberately do the record first, because we don't want it staged until we've done the score. It worked again.
And you had the wonderful Julie Covington.
Yeah, she was great. She was on Rock Follies, a big TV show at the time.
Yeah, I loved Rock Follies.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. Andy Mackay wrote the
song. Andy Mackay, yeah.
Let me get this. Charlotte Cornwell.
Yeah.
Who is the sister of the famous...
David Cornwell.
Who is...
John le Carré.
John le Carré.
Right.
Sorry.
And Rula Lenska. Yeah. And fourth lady joined called Sue Jones Davies. And they were all great in different ways. And that was one of the reasons why the show worked, because, you know, you had these four disparate characters coming together to form an all-girl group, which was much rarer then than it is now. But Julie, her voice seemed to be the one that we thought would work best for Evita. And we had no idea whether she'd agree to do it, but she did. We got in touch with her and she came round and liked it. And we began recording it with her.
And David Essex as Che Guevara.
Well, David, who was brilliant...
Is Che Guevara? Or is it Che, just the narrator?
It really is Che Guevara.
It is Che Guevara, yeah, okay.
Even though they may never have met. They could have met, but I don't think they did. No, David was not on the original record.
Ah.
We were very lucky to get Colm Wilkinson, who is a wonderful singer.
Who went on to star in Les Mis, right?
Yes. Les Mis was what kicked Colm into stardom. But on this album, he was terrific. On the Evita album, he was the first person to sing that role. But when we got to the London West End show, neither Covington didn't want to do it. Colm Wilkinson, I think he was away at the time, or Hal Prince wanted somebody, you know, with a different sort of voice. I can't remember what it was. But David Essex, we approached David because A, he was very talented, and B, he was a big name. We felt we didn't need a big name, but it happened that one very big name was also very good, and that was David Essex. And David did a brilliant job.
But hadn't you already written a hit single for him, or was that afterwards?
No, Mike Batt, who you know well, Gary, I'm sure you do as well, Guy. Mike Batt did a brilliant cover version of Oh, What a Circus with David, which was not the version.
Oh, yes, of course.
All right.
The cast album with Elaine Page and David Essex, that was a different recording of Oh, What a Circus. Mike did a wonderful arrangement of it, and it was a big hit single for David. And we never thought either Don't Cry at Me, Argentina, or Oh, What a Circus would be hit singles. Once I heard David's version with Mike Batt, and once I heard Julie's final version, we thought maybe these could be hits.
To bring this up, how do you write? Is it you and Andrew on it together, or is it like an Elton and Bernie thing?
Good question.
In the same room?
I mean, like most writers, I imagine, who have separate jobs to a great extent, you have to do your job more or less on your own. I can't write a lyric if there's anything going on in the next room, or if there's any major distraction.
But have you already got Andrew's tune?
But I've already got the tune. All I need.
Ah, okay.
And by that point, don't grab me Argentina. In those days, I'd have a cassette. I'd play the cassette at home. And then, of course, after a few plays, you've got the tune in your head. So you don't need that, except at the end when you want to play the whole thing back and sing along with it to see if it fits. We would together, I would say, right, this is probably the first scene. This is the second scene. We need a song here that's a funeral. This one needs a love song. This one needs a rocker, whatever.
But do you ever have a title to give to Andrew, say, so you can get the scansion of the title into the melody?
Occasionally. I'm not sure that I did have very many actual titles before, if any, but Andrew would write a melody or a piece of music that fitted the mood, and that would often give me the title. Certainly Don't Cry With Me Argentina was a title that we didn't put into the last
one. That's right. I'm wondering if you ever say had a title that inspired Andrew.
No, I like to think that the storyline I was offering him inspired him, and it did, because right. I think the Evita score is terrific. But yeah. I don't remember giving him a title. I might have done, but I can't remember doing that. I mean, Oh, What a Circus was the first lyric I wrote to one of Andrew's melodies. And that, of course, that melody is the same melody as Don't Cry For Me Argentina, but done in a different way.
I love this dissection of songwriting, because one of the key things about writing in a musical as opposed to writing a pop song is that, we're told, is that in a pop song is just a snapshot of emotion, where in a musical, a song has to have drama running through it. Something has to change within the song.
So the character start at point A and end at point B.
Is in a different place. Yeah. Yeah. Is that something that you're always keen on doing? Or, you know, is another suitcase, another room? Does that have that in it? Or was that a straight up pop song?
Well, that was the one song, Another Suitcase in Another Hall, that we thought would work out of context.
Oh, and didn't someone come up with a line in the studio with the answer bit?
I don't think so. We wrote that one in Biarritz. Sounds rather grand, but we went off to...
Yeah, it does.
Yes. Yeah. So I should have said Brighton or Shoreham or something. But we went off, we took a room, a couple of rooms in a hotel to get out of the way and actually concentrate, not be distracted, which is daft to go to Biarritz if you don't want to be distracted. But we did write about five or six songs there, including Another Suitcase. And we felt at the time that that was something that would work out of the show. And we expected that if there were to be a pop hit, we thought that would be it. But I don't remember the answer phrases coming in later. I think they were always there.
Okay.
Yeah, so we don't want to cause us any kind of lawsuits.
No, it was probably someone angling for glory. Yeah. It happens a lot.
The character's drama shifting within a tune, is that important to you as a lyricist, Tim?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, the job of a song, as you were implying there, the job of a song in a show is often as much to get the story moving on and get the character developed as it is to have a good song. But you've still got to make it a song that people enjoy hearing, otherwise they'll drift off. Like, you know, a good bit of dialogue in any straight play, if it's entertaining, besides being factual, it will hold the attention better. And in a way, I find it easier at times to write a song or a scene which has to get from A to B, has to tell a story, has to put something over. Because I don't know, I mean, Gary, when you write your great songs, I'm absolutely baffled as to sometimes how you come up with an idea which appears to be a brilliant 3-minute snapshot, if you like, of life, of an attitude. And from that, you can write something like, you know...
Without being guided by drama.
Yes, but which I find very difficult. I mean, I've hardly ever had any success with a song that wasn't in some way inspired by a story that I was writing that wasn't a part of a story. It's always been important to me or put it this way, it's always been inspirational to me if I'm telling a story. If I'm just writing a one-off song, I'm not sure I can do it.
I think with songs, with pop songs, I think it's all about trying to shift perspectives so that you're not in the same version every verse, and that certainly when you get to a mid late, you come right out of your character and you're looking more objectively at a situation. So you do a sort of staging, if you like, when you're writing a pop song from different angles of perception.
But also, actually, Tim, I want to ask you, Gary and I have done some musical writing together, and there's all sorts of theory and stuff, isn't there, involved? And that's one, did you just learn to write musicals as you went along, or did you study the theory of, like, you need to hear your main theme by here, and this character needs to have strong rhymes, and this needs to...
Well, I didn't, and I would say Andrew probably did, in as much as he had an incredible knowledge of musicals and how they were structured. I liked a lot of musicals, when I was a kid, but I hadn't actually seen any of them. I'd only heard them on record as I was a vinyl junkie. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that we didn't obey the rules was why we were successful, or one of the reasons, because Jesus Christ Superstar and indeed Evita, they broke a lot of the rules, you know, the subject matter, the mm-hmm. format, the way they were introduced to the world. And I've always said, when people ask me, how do you write a hit musical? I say, well, you know, I don't really know, except you've got to remember the rule is there are no rules and no one knows anything. And people, you know, as I think I said earlier, they'd say you can't write about Jesus because everybody knows the story, and you can't write about Eva Perón because nobody knows the story. Well, ludicrous. You know, you can write about anything, in theory anyway, I believe. You can write about almost anything if you just approach it with some sort of originality and a few good tunes.
And were you happy with Madonna? I mean, of course you were happy, but I mean, would you have imagined that?
I was very glad about Madonna doing it because I felt she had, you know, some similarities with Eva. She was a very determined, unusual woman. And I think she did a very good job in the film, actually. I was slightly disappointed for her that she didn't turn it into a bigger film career. I mean, I was slightly surprised.
Can I ask about, they're putting musicals on into film? Because invariably, the actors are miming. And I always have a little problem with that. I prefer to see them on stage, emoting, physically involved in presenting the words directly to the audience. Mostly in films, they're having to mime. Did you have an issue with that at all, Tim?
I was not deeply involved with either the Superstar or Evita movies. And I was delighted they were being done, and I, you know, thought that both of them had good points and perhaps the odd weak point as well. But you're right, I would agree with you completely. With a musical, it's much, you get the essence of the piece much more completely on stage than you do in film. You're right, and sometimes, of course, in some films, like My Fair Lady, they're miming to someone else's voice.
Yeah.
Also, you've got actors doing something they're not used to doing. Pop singers are used to miming, a life on top of the Pops, whereas actors have never done it.
I mean, Madonna, it's interesting, we wrote a new song for her. She wanted a new song, and you know, we all wanted a shot at an Oscar, because you've got to have an original song that hasn't been heard before if you want to be in line for an Oscar. And normally people stick a new song into a film, because Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, or any song in a Evita film could not win the Oscar because they'd been around before. Nominated songs for Oscars have to be brand new in the film, first time they're heard. So if we wanted to have a outside chance, we had to write a new song, and we wrote one for Madonna, and almost by mistake it was a jolly good song.
What was it, Tim? Remind me.
You Must Love Me, a top 10 hit for her on the American charts as well, and it was really something that turned out so well. I mean, A, it did win the Oscar, but B, it worked well enough for virtually every show now of Evita, every stage show adds that song in the show, which is great.
And now we're on this. Can we just bring up, sorry, I'm very sorry if I'm breaking your story, that you are that rare breed, an EGOT.
Yes, I don't know who invented EGOTs. I mean,
well, can I just say, I think it would be much more distinguished sounding to be a toge.
I know, an EGOT sounds like a very angry seagull.
Yeah, toge, surely. Tony, Oscar, Grammy, Emmy.
these are the four awards that count. I mean, you know, you could have said, you know, life-saving medal, I don't know. I mean, it's... I'd never really heard of EGOTs until quite recently. And now you seem to be hearing them all the time. You know, he's got an EGOT, or I don't know.
That sounds like a Lionel Bart song. Yes, he's got an EGOT.
It certainly rhymes with a lot of things.
No, it was, I mean, I appreciated that enormously. It was nice to get one. The Emmy was for being producers of the fairly recent television version of Superstar, which was done live in New York and filmed for television. It was a television special. And my
amazing,
main, John Legend and Sarah Bareilles and Brandon Bixen-Dixon. And it was my main contribution was suggesting the wonderful Alice Cooper as Herod, which he did brilliantly.
Yeah. Brilliant. Inspired.
And, that suggestion got me an Emmy, as far as I can see.
And Grammys, obviously, they go without saying.
I find Grammys an interesting science to study, because I know that the Madonna song, You Must Love Me, wasn't even nominated. And I was a bit surprised as it won the Oscar as best song from, and apparently Warner Brothers or somebody who was meant to fill in the form didn't. And,
it's a form filling
thing. Which is silly, because I would imagine that the panel of experts who are choosing the Grammys, the nominations, should know enough about each category to make their choices themselves without relying on the record companies to send stuff in.
Tim, I don't know how long we have. We've really taken up a lot of your time, and we haven't mentioned, I mean, we are, you know, as we said earlier, being a rock programme, as it were, we still haven't mentioned Elton John, and we haven't mentioned Bjorn and Benny of ABBA.
Chess. Exactly.
I mean, there's so much that we need to talk to you about.
We can always do a part two, you know.
A question I would like to ask you is, what do you feel you're most proud of?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, I think I'm quite realistic about some of my stuff. I mean, I think in a way the best idea I had was Ava Perón, in a sense, because following Superstar was almost harder than doing it in the first place. Whatever we chose to follow Superstar with, most people, including me, thought we'd never be able to follow it. And I think that was a brilliant idea. And I didn't really know it was a brilliant idea, but it grabbed me so quickly. I thought this could work. And, you know, I mean, Andrew would admit this happened. It took him a while to think it was a good idea. But once he did get it, he wrote the most wonderful score. And I think in terms of both our careers, I think that was the one that really ensured we were going to be around for a while.
You made your difficult second album into a massive hit.
Exactly. That was exactly it. And, you know, I mean, it's very difficult to say. I mean, I never thought Hakuna Matata would become so popular as a sort of children's or song for children of all ages. But that one I hear on the radio almost more than anything else.
Yeah.
And as Elton said, he said, I've been in this business for however many years it is, 30, 40 years, and I end up writing a song about a farting warthog. And is this progress? And I say, well, I think it is probably. You're going to win the Oscar.
We haven't really got, because I really wanted to hit on Chess.
Well, I mean, listen, the last thing I want to do is to tell you what to do, but if you want to, in, you know, a few months' time, do one on Chess, so I can probably do a whole show on that.
I think we should get
what
you
went
back.
Wrong.
I think this is.
I think we should get you back because it wouldn't do it justice because I'm so.
No, and this is the time in the show where it says next on Rock on Tours, although in a few months, you know, and we'll go, you know, Andrew and Tim break up, you know.
Yes.
ABBA get involved.
Yeah. Well, also, the thing I love is that because your story of you and Andrew getting together is at the same time and it's the same story as Elton and Bernie. And there's this really funny parallel universe where you've just spent your life writing for Elton and Bernie's been writing for Andrew.
Well, what is even more extraordinary about the Elton thing was that Elton and Bernie were on MCA, which is our label in America and in here. Mm-hmm. Actually, no, they were on DJM over here, but in America, they hit hugely. Elton became a big star almost overnight with his first major album. And he became a major star just at the same time that we did, although he was a performer, we were writers. And MCA had both of them. And furthermore, we both had huge albums in America. And both those albums flopped initially in Great Britain. It was extraordinary. There was an incredible parallel with our careers. And, you know, I was saying to Andrew, I'm a bit worried about this new Elton John chap. MCA putting a rather lot of effort behind him. You know, have they forgotten about Superstar? And I'm sure Elton was saying, what the hell's going on with this Superstar thing? You know?
Yeah.
And
it was this sort of Blur Oasis thing going on between.
we were in different, you know, areas of the music world, but we were on the same label at the same time and hitting it big in the same country. It was strange. And, I mean, I've obviously got to know Elton very well and had the great privilege of working with him on several projects. But at the time, I would never have, you know, it was extraordinary. I would never have dreamt that, you know, 30 years on, seeing him at the Fillmore West on his first album, I would have thought, I don't think I'll be writing with Elton. Because,
wow, you were there. Fantastic.
Well, we saw him in the Fillmore East in New York. I was not at the Troubadour when he broke big.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, should have been. MCA should have invited us. But I think we were probably in England at the time.
Tim, it's been great having you on. We must have you back. I mean, I think we, you know, it's fascinating talking to you. You've got so many great stories and what a career. And thank you for coming on Rock on Tours.
It's so nice to, you know, chat to blokes who know what they're talking about.
Very kind. You've just worked your way into the title sequence.
You just got yourself into the intro. Yeah, right. There you go.
Okay, well, it's lovely to see you. And Gary, I'm sure I'll see you very soon. The last few weeks, we've been running into each other every 6 hours, which is...
And it's always, always a pleasure to see you, Tim. We'll have you on for part two sometime in the future.
Well,
thank you so much.
Thanks, Gary. It's been great.
Thank you, Tim. Really, it was a delight and an honour.
All the very
thank
best. You. See you soon.
Bye.
Cheers.
Bye.
Oh, that was great.
That was brilliant. That was fantastic. I'm kind of getting bored of saying this, that we only scratch the surface.
I know. I don't want that to be our catchphrase. I don't want that to be the sort of under the title
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, rock on tours. They barely scratch the surface.
Thanks for the oversell. But, you know, we could have gone on and on.
I think there's a part two. You know what? I think there's quite a few people we might be looking at a part two.
Yeah, frankly. Yeah. But, you know, the guy wrote with Benny and Bjorn and Rick Wakeman, and of course Freddie Mercury as well.
Yeah.
He wrote some songs for Freddie Mercury, and he wrote the last song that Elvis ever recorded. Doesn't sound very good, does it? That was the song that killed him, but no, the last song he ever recorded. I love the guy, such a nice
yeah,
man.
Yeah, no, I love him. Yeah, someone said they were at a musical masterclass, something that he did, and he was using Handful of Songs as an example of a perfect bit of songwriting, which is why I brought it up.
And it's so touching that your dad gets to have that connection yeah. as well.
Yeah, lovely. And I always have a bit of family in somewhere, then it's funny.
Yeah. You are Mr. Showbiz.
I am Mr. Showbiz. Cut me, I bleed showbiz.
Well, thanks for listening. We will be back next week with another great guest. I'm not quite sure who it is yet, but we'll find out.
We never are. It's seat of the pants.
Can
stuff,
I just say, can so I just add one last thing? We didn't talk about your friend, a father who passed away this week.
Leslie Bricus,
the great songwriter.
Yeah, I know. Who's absolutely of that stable. Yeah.
We should just mention him before we go.
We should mention that one of the absolute all-time greats had that amazing partnership with Anthony Newley, amongst other things. Yeah, I had the honour of meeting him a few times. And yeah, what a talent, and the world has lost one of the, you know, brightest lights.
The great songwriters.
Yeah.
We'll see you next week. It's good night from me.
And it's good night from me.